If you ever took a science class in high school or college, you might remember that there were two portions of the class. There was the lecture, and then there was the lab. The lecture portion of the class was where the teacher stood at the front and told you what you needed to learn. There might have been a chalkboard, textbooks, some other means of conveying information, quizzes or tests might have been part of the grading structure for the lecture. But the other part of the class, the lab, was equally, if not more important, often to my chagrin, especially in classes like chemistry. Lab or laboratory involved putting into practice the things that you were learning in the lecture. You had to actually titrate that chemical or isolate that compound or dissect that creature. And then you had to write up what you observed, and you were graded not on your smart answers, but instead on whether or not you could actually make the thing happen in the laboratory that was supposed to happen. I propose, and Kim will talk more in a few moments about this in a different way, but I propose that the purpose of religious education, religious communities, is to serve as the lab. This, what's happening right here in this room right now, this might be the lecture portion of our religious education. But what is far more important is whether we can actually practice it. Whether we can really do what we say we believe. Now, forgive me for this comedian reference. I know this is not the best person to look to for advice. But the comedian Louis C.K. talked in one of his shows about the things that he believes. He says he doesn't actually live any of them out. They just make him feel good to believe them. He says they're comforting and cuddly, and he kind of goes like this. He says, they're my believies. Now, based on CK's aw shucks good guy stage routines, compared to the many disturbing allegations against him from women, I would say that he's probably spot on. Those things that he professed that he believed that made him feel like a good guy, those were his believies. But he never really bothered to incorporate them into his lived experience. And I bet if we all thought about it for a moment, we would all recognize some of the things that are our believies. And this is why we need each other, to provide the space for practicing and encouraging and challenging each other to live out the values that we espouse, that we say we believe. The famed UU minister James Luther Adams is remembered as having said something like, "Church is where you practice being human." This fellowship can be that place of practice, not just for our children and youth, but for each of us. Through our small groups, our committee work, interactions in coffee hour, choir rehearsal, justice making, and so much more, we could be constantly practicing the seven principles rather than just claiming that we uphold them. I often say that I don't care if our kids, or you, or I for that matter, can memorize the seven principles. So don't worry, you don't have to memorize the seven principles. I haven't. But I prefer that instead we actually live them. A simple example of this is our upholding a value of fairness and right relationship. We say we value fairness and right relationship. Now, we could tell our preschool RE class that they should share and they should be kind to each other. We could do that. We could tell them that. Or we could set up the classroom environment so that they have to share. For example, by not having enough scissors to go around, or having activity stations that only seat two or three at a time so that they have to figure out how to take turns. The teachers or facilitators could assist the preschoolers in figuring that out, navigating that, but mostly it would be a laboratory to encourage the kids to figure it out for themselves. This is the Wonder Box, practicing wondering. This is the offering, practicing generosity. It's far more effective for learning to actually practice than to just hear it. Now, in education, we often talk about curricula or curriculum. And when we talk about using a curriculum, what people often hear when they hear that is that you're finding a written lesson, either in a book or online, and then you adapt that lesson and activities, and then you implement those in the classroom. That's what we mean when we say curriculum. But educational experts are using that word curriculum to mean something much broader than that. They mean, what are we teaching? And so there are three kinds of curricula that I want to explore with you today. And I want to ask the question, what are we teaching here at this fellowship? Not just to our children and youth, but to each other. So the first of these three is called the explicit curriculum. This is explicit. This is what we usually say out loud. This is the most obvious of what we teach. You'll find our community's explicit curriculum on our website, in our pamphlets, written down, or regularly said from the pulpit. Our seven principles would be an example of an explicit curriculum that we teach here. Our desire to be truly welcoming to all, as named in our welcoming words that we say each week, that would be an example of an explicit curriculum, something that we teach. I'm wondering, if you'll play with me for a moment, can you think of any other explicit curricula that we teach here? Any examples? None. What about our six sources? Yeah. Do you have an idea? What do you think? What do we teach here? No? We teach that our chalice is important, that it's a sacred symbol. The music that we sing, the kind of music we sing, yeah, it's an explicit message. Social justice, right? We say it, we put it on our banner out there, we talk about it. John, you were going to say social justice. Caring about each other through our joys and concerns. Living green, yeah, right? We call ourselves, right? We wash our own cups, those are, and we say it, right? So the key with explicit is that do we say it or we write it down, we put it on our website. We are a green sanctuary, right? Partnership, our partnership with international partners. All right, I'm sure there's a million more. This is good. I like that you're engaging with this. The second curriculum is called the implicit curriculum. Now, this is what we don't say out loud or write down, but we teach by doing. Implicit curriculum are sometimes a little harder to notice. They're more subtle. They're no less powerful. In fact, they're often more powerful than the explicit curriculum because we do it. And sometimes, not always, but sometimes when we notice our implicit curricula, we might feel a little bit uncomfortable. Like, ooh, I'm not sure I want that to be the message that we're sending. One of our implicit curricula here is that coffee is really important. If you like tea, that's fine, but you're not really a UU, right? Now, that's not true. We wouldn't put that in a pamphlet. But our sort of worship of coffee is an implicit message. Another one might be the green one, that we live it. We wash our cups. We recycle. We have green bulbs in our fixtures. Another one is that we have a pretty high expectation of literacy here, that reading, either from our hymnal or on the screen, is often an expectation in our community. So that's not, we're not saying it out loud that you have to be highly literate to be part of our community, but we kind of teach it by doing. Are there any other implicit curricula that you can think of that we do here? John? We value marginalized voices by putting them in the pulpit, right? We try to do that. We probably could be doing it more, right? To make it a stronger implicit message. Lay ministry, yeah, that we value the voices of the people, both our lay ministers and through congregational response. That's an implicit curriculum. Rana? Right. We value our children. We incorporate them into the service. A secondary, maybe not quite as lovely implicit message is that we then sing them away. Now, I'm not saying that we should or shouldn't do that. I'm just saying there is an implicit curriculum there that we either expect that they can't handle sitting here, or they shouldn't, or that somehow their presence regularly on a regular basis would deprive the adults of something. I'm not agreeing or disagreeing with that statement. I'm just saying it's the implicit curriculum. Jenny? Yeah, our governance is very, very active. Our governing board is elected from among us. We don't have some outside authority telling us what to do. One more. Giving is optional, right? So the explicit is we are generous. We give here every week. We do this thing. And the implicit is if you want to, right? Yeah, absolutely. Another one, an implicit message is that we're all Democrats. We don't say that out loud. We don't put it on our banner. But the fact that if someone makes a joke or something, or says something about the other Republican Party or something, people laugh, people groan. The implicit message there is that if you are not in the party line, that you are outside. Another one is that religious education is only for kids. We even call our program for children religious education, which means anything not for them isn't that. And that's not true, right? Our last one is called the null or hidden curriculum. And this one's tricky. It's what we teach by avoiding it altogether. An example of a hidden curriculum could be in some communities or families that our bodies are bad or dirty because we refuse to talk about our bodies at all, or if we do, we use cute code words to describe our body parts. And what we teach by doing that is that we're teaching that our bodies are something we should be ashamed of because we just don't talk about it. Another null curriculum is that in some schools, Black history is not American history. That's the curriculum. Because Black history is only taught during Black History Month, and it's sort of glorified or exoticized during that month. So the curriculum then is, it's separate. Right? Now I wonder, and if you can't think of any, that's fine, but I wonder if you can think of any null curricula that we teach here. Being rich is bad. That's interesting. God or church, we avoid that. Yeah, that was top one on my list, and that was also named at the last service, so I'm glad you're paying attention. I'm not saying that we should all use these words or believe in God or be a Christian or anything like that, but the idea that if you are religious or Christian, you're somehow not you enough. Or worse, you're dumb. Emma is cheering quietly back there. Have you learned this null curriculum here, Emma? Yeah. Right, exactly, yeah. So, and now I'm not saying that we have to create an explicit curriculum that we're all Christian, because we're not. We're absolutely not. But the idea that we're very, very welcoming, unless you say the word God. Right? And then suddenly, there's this, the null curriculum kicks in. And the children, Emma has grown up here, she's a youth, the children have picked up on it. So we don't necessarily want that to be our curriculum, right? The other thing is that we teach that the family is not necessarily a conveyor of religious education. The religious education happens here for 1 hour a week, then you're done. The null curriculum is that you're not carrying your faith out into the world, and we want that to become an explicit curriculum. There's a lot more. I hope you guys, we could keep talking about this all day. But my passion for religious education stems from a deep desire to transform our implicit and null curricula into our explicit curricula, that we make them all explicit. And then we examine what we really want to be teaching. And that we actually practice what we preach, that we use our time here at the fellowship on Sunday mornings or any other time to provide a laboratory of practice, a way to live out and embody the beliefs that we hold: welcome, dignity for all, fairness, justice, love, compassion, generosity. This need not be an uncomfortable or radical idea. It could be a lot of fun to dream together about the ways that we can create this place as a microcosm of the beloved community that we envision. A laboratory for the spirit of love for all of us, not just our children. And so when we think about religious education, we need to stop thinking about it only as something that Kim is responsible for, or something that only happens in the wing over there, but that it is something that we all do together, young and old and in between, throughout our whole lives, all the time, exploring, refining, and practicing our beliefs, lest they become our believies.
I have been serving this congregation as director of religious education for almost 7 years. And in this time, I have become intimately familiar with all of the facets of our religious education programs for our young people. The students, parents, teachers, those who passionately serve this community and its needs. I'm proud of the way that we educate, of the way that we work together to help our young people explore, understand, and create their own life path centered on a responsible search for truth and meaning and a Unitarian Universalist identity. And it's time to change. More than 20 years ago, the UUA published a book entitled The Essex Conversations, which is a collection of essays by various religious professionals about how our movement, and in particular our religious education programs, will progress into the 21st century. The message at that time was clear. It was change or die. So it was no surprise when the jarringly named seminal article known to the liberal religious education community as The Death of Sunday School, but wholly entitled The Death of Sunday School and the Future of Faith Formation, was published 2 years ago by Kim Sweeney, a UUA credentialed religious educator in New England. The article shook the world of liberal religious education. It brings the same argument into a sharper focus. The way that we educate is no longer viable. So just for fun, the article begins, "The Sunday school model of religious education died in New England 2 decades ago." To me, this article is a real cliffhanger because it offers no concrete solutions. Rather, we are left to our own devices with some clues of how to discover our own path. But isn't that what we do? I see this as a daunting and exciting venture at the same time. Through speculation, publications, and experiments within the Unitarian Universalist Association, one thing is clear. In order to thrive, we need to become a community of intergenerational teachers and learners. So, now what? The first and most important step is for us to make a paradigm shift, to see ourselves as a teaching and learning community. All of us. One of my favorite quotes from Richard Gilbert, who is the retired senior minister of the First Unitarian Church of Rochester in New York, says, "The purpose of life is to grow a soul, to love and to be loved, and to help repair the world. In a faith where one is expected to build one's own theology in a community of seekers, religious education is at all ages and stages is imperative. He goes on, Unitarian Universalist faith development is an absorbing adventure of the spirit, end quote. Garrett says that following a liberal religious path is an experiment in living, that curiosity is a feature which should last until the very end of our days. The Unitarian Universalists should be counted as members, and I love this part, as the church of perpetual curiosity. Gilbert wants us to recognize that our whole community is a teaching and learning laboratory, which gives us the opportunity for all to grow and to engage in the religious quest with fellow seekers, regardless of where we are on our individual journeys. So what would that look like? One of the authors of that 20-year-old book that I told you about, The Essex Conversations, shares her vision of what such a community should look like. Her name is Judith Fridini, and she says, quote, what would a congregation engaged in lifespan religious education look like? It would be the ultimate committee of the whole, a community in which everyone is seen as teacher and learner, in which every age and stage of life is equally valued and equally supported by whatever tangible and intangible resources the community has to offer, in which every age and stage of life is allowed to contribute whatever tangible and intangible resources the community has to offer. A community in which no decision is made about the life of the community, whether in the areas of worship, the building, fundraising, social action, the arts, education, or any other, without consideration of its impact on and opportunities for each member of the community, end quote. So now, let's talk about us. What if we followed this vision? What might it look like for us? What are our tangible and intangible resources? So first, I have to say that I have been so excited for today because it's my chance to finally share a secret that I and those involved in the religious education community have known forever, that the young people of this fellowship are our best kept secret. And this should not be a secret. It was so thrilling to hear from one of our teachers when she talked to a group of people about a personal joy that she was really excited to share. She said, I spent time with our elementary kids this week, and I am so impressed by their deep understanding of environmental issues. I feel really positive about our future. What if this would be common knowledge rather than the privilege of a certain few? We could all feel this. Let me give you an example of what this could look like, something that was generated by our senior social group, which is made up of mostly folks in their retirement years. Members of this group asked to meet with our high school youth to help them troubleshoot ideas that they were having with their phones, their tablets, etc. This was a really genius idea. It was a great idea. The kids were excited to help. They met one-on-one, they had a day of teaching and learning, and it was a success. Things like this could happen more often and ideally without having to set them up artificially, because we will already be integrated enough that it could easily happen naturally. This summer, we will be experimenting with this during a weekend summer camp by having members and friends come for a day to share something that they are passionate about with our young kids. And after we learn how this works by doing it, we will then be able to expand it. We have a huge community of individuals who have expertise in all different areas. What are you passionate about that you could share with the kids? What if we turned this on its head, and the kids share their passions with us? We talk with our really young children about coming to the fellowship and that it's like coming to be with our church family. We do this because we want them to know that they are in a loving and safe community. And largely, it's an ideal. But what if it became a reality where we see the fellowship as an extended family of spiritual seekers? Our fellowship could be a place where elders don't have to feel lonely, where parents can feel supported, where we all have connections with one another, and age is not an obstacle, but an asset. So I have to caution us. Creating this for ourselves will be a nonlinear process. It will be more organic than organized. It will arise and it will not be manufactured. We will need to be ready to follow where it takes us and to learn from our failures and our victories. It will be an opportunity to practice our third principle of active and collective learning, of accepting one another and encouraging one another towards spiritual growth. So, what will the future of religious education look like for us? We have a direction. It is a lifespan learning and teaching community. The rest will be co-created by all of us, and we will be richer for it. So I'm going to leave you with words from Judith Friedini, who is the Essex Conversation person that we heard from earlier. She says, genuine respect for all ages and truly intergenerational communities are countercultural prospects that will require institutional transformation to be fully realized. To the extent that religious education is synonymous with kids, religious educator is associated with child care, and children, youth, and those that serve them are marginalized, we are not achieving the depth and vitality that we could as a faith community and a teaching and learning community. Yet creating this lifespan bridge is one of the most valuable gifts a religious community can offer. And so, amen. May it be so.